WHFR, Dearborn. This is WHFR, Dearborn.
I'm from X, and we're talking to real smokers about quitting. Tell me when you smoke and why you smoke.
First thing I do in the morning is get some coffee and have a cigarette.
If I have a cup of coffee, I gotta have a cigarette.
As soon as I wake up.
Okay.
With coffee, after I eat, and in between snacks.
Okay.
When I'm bored.
Pretty much all the time.
Yeah.
Have you tried to quit?
I quit for 3 months, went out one night, bought a pack of cigarettes, and that was the end.
I've actually tried to quit cold turkey, and that's really hard.
You ever hear about stories like, and then he threw the pack out the window, and he never smoked again?
Now, I've actually heard a guy throw a pack out the window, but he went to go buy another pack.
What would you do different?
Actually having a plan and thinking it through.
It's like you have to relearn yourself not to smoke. Especially at times when you really know this is the time I have the cigarette, like in the morning after coffee.
You have to relearn how to live your life without a cigarette in your hand.
With the right plan, you can quit smoking. Free at becomeanx.org. X, a new way to think about quitting. Brought to you by X and the Ad Council.
Henry Ford Community College gift cards are a great way to show your support for someone in your life who is seeking the skills necessary to fulfill their dreams. Available in values from $10 to $100, gift cards can be used towards payment of tuition, purchasing books and supplies, lab fees, or even a lunch at Skylight Cafe. Gift cards can be purchased at the campus bookstore or online at collegestore.hfcc.edu. College gift cards. What better way to encourage a student in your life than with an investment in their future?
Old and new, hot and cool. It's nothing but the finest blues on Highway 61. I'm Joanne Korchenska. Please join me every Friday from 2 until 6 p.m. for great blues music. Only at WHFR.FM, celebrating 25 years of independent radio.
Disclaimer. This show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Hey, this is Derek, and listen to Skepticality, the official podcast of Skeptic Magazine, for Tuesday, April 24th, 2012. Welcome back to another episode of Skepticality, the show that brings you news and interviews with scientists, skeptics, and thinkers of all sorts for the promotion of critical thinking and science. That was Hai Ting Chin, a mezzo-soprano and co-host of the Scopes Monkey Choir, the podcast where music and sound meet science and skepticism. If you are interested in extra musical flair with your skeptical thought, you might want to go over there and take a listen to their podcast. Check out the link to their show in the show notes for this episode. Well, up next is my good friend, Tim Folley, with Skepticism Past and Future for Events Surrounding the Current Date.
Hi, this is Tim Farley of whatstheharm.net and skeptools.com, and this is Skepticism Past and Future. This week in the past, we've got skeptical topics in conventional news media, but in the future, we've got the newspaper industry adapting to the internet. Newspapers, particularly the tabloid press, have always been a challenge for skeptics. Cryptozoology, poltergeists, conspiracy theories, you name it. Nothing is too wild for certain tabloids to push in a rush to sell a few extra papers. And even the mainstream papers get in the act sometimes. As an example, consider the Loch Ness Monster. The early elements of the legend very much played out in the British or Scottish press. Even the use of the word monster itself originated with an Inverness Courier article on May 2, 1933. And the most famous image of the alleged creature, the one that is invariably shown in any documentary about it, this so-called surgeon's photograph. It was made famous when it was published in the Daily Mail on April 21, 1934. We now know it was a hoax, but the damage is long done. It's not all pseudoscience in the papers, of course. Sometimes skeptics get some coverage, too. For instance, the May 6, 1991 issue of Time magazine included a major expose of Scientology that was titled The Thriving Cult of Greed and Power. And on April 19, 2008, The Guardian newspaper in the UK published Simon Singh's chiropractic article, Beware the Spinal Trap. It was this article that led to a protracted legal battle between Singh and British chiropractors that lasted 2 years. Here in the future, newspapers are in big trouble. They are losing readers and money left and right, as the public has switched to the internet for their news. Newspapers were slow to embrace this and have stumbled in trying to make money during this transition. Because of this stumble, non-traditional sources of news, such as blogs, podcasts, and social media, are taking over the role once played by newspapers. While they have many positive qualities, these new tools often lack editorial experience and fail to do adequate fact-checking. This has led to an environment where misinformation is rampant and can spread rapidly on social media. Among forward-thinking journalists, all of this has spawned an interest in ways to combat online misinformation. This is something that has always interested me. It is why I created my SkepTools blog. In March, a symposium about this problem was held at Harvard called Truthiness in Digital Media. They discussed the scope of the problem and possible ways to address it. Naturally, as news people, they were focused much on political spin and PR. But the problems and techniques naturally apply to skeptic topics, too. I encourage you to check out the symposium website. In February, the Knight Foundation launched its latest News Challenge, which is a contest to find worthy news-related projects for grants. They have up to $5 million to give away. This round is focused on networks, and a number of the proposals are related to combating misinformation online. This includes Hypothesis and Rebutter, two tools that I've discussed here before, as well as some other tools called Truth Teller, Truth Goggles, and several others. The judging is not yet finished, and the final decision will be made in the next few months. I find it interesting how the rise of misinformation has caused this intersection between the interests of forward-thinking journalists and the interests of skeptics. Hopefully, we can work together in the future. And this brings us to the end of another edition of Skepticism, Past and Future. Links to additional material are in the show notes, as always, and follow me on Twitter or Facebook under the name Krelnik, K-R-E-L-N-I-K, for a daily fact from skepticism's past and ongoing news of skepticism's future.
Remember that cool news segment we discussed on the last episode? Well, the odds are you get to hear it. Well, next.
Hello, and welcome to The Odds Must Be Crazy on Skepticality, where we read the craziest stories from the site out loud so you can put down your tablet and drive safely. I'm Jarrett Kaufman.
And I'm Wendy Hughes.
and we'll be your guides through the probability-infested waters.
Today's story comes to us courtesy of friend of the blog and Independent Investigations Group steering committee member, Spencer Marks. It can be found on our blog today by searching for Slow and Steady Stays at Home, also linked to in the show notes. Spencer writes,
a few years ago, I was driving home and saw something moving in the middle of the street on the north end of the block that my house was on. When I got close enough, I realized it was a 12-inch California desert tortoise just walking down the middle of the street in broad daylight and in the middle of the city. Not wanting him to get run over, I picked him up and took him to my house. He seemed very comfortable around people, since when he would see someone approach, he would actually run toward the approaching person, well, as fast as a tortoise can run, presumably to get fed. I figured he must have been hand-raised, since he had absolutely no fear of humans at all and seemed to enjoy their company. A month later, I was talking to a friend, one I didn't talk to that often, about him coming to pick up some equipment from my house, and he asked for my address. As soon as I gave it to him, he said, "Oh, wow, I grew up on that very street, just at the other end of the block from you." We then talked a bit about who was in the neighborhood when he was growing up, and who still had a house there, and all of that sort of stuff. And for some reason, he said, "I had a pet tortoise when I was a kid, and we couldn't find it when we moved out, so I wonder if it's still at that house." I almost fell over. I told him that I had just found a tortoise in the street directly in front of his old house the month before. He had moved away over 30 years prior to that, so I assumed it must have just been a different tortoise. But when he came to my house to pick up the equipment, he took one look at the tortoise and said, "Yep, that's him." I asked him if he wanted him back, and he said no. So today Speedy lives with me at my new house, with lots of places to roam and spoiled with fruits and veggies by all who see him.
Spencer is a friend of ours, and it doesn't surprise us in the least that his instinct was to care for the tortoise instead of ignoring it, hitting it with his car, or considering what herbs would go well with it in a soup. But this story still struck us as pretty entertaining and surprising, so we decided to pass it by our friend, cognitive psychologist, statistician, and credibility booster Barbara Drescher, for her analysis. Here are a few highlights and paraphrasings from her response. The full text is available underneath the story on our blog.
Given the number of people with which Spencer was likely to interact in the weeks following finding the tortoise, and the likelihood that some of those people lived in that neighborhood at some time in their lives, interacting with the tortoise's previous owner is less unusual than it appears. The tortoise coming up in conversation is not that unusual either. Any mention of where Spencer lived was bound to spark a conversation about the fact that the friend once lived there, and that topic is likely to spark memories of the pet left behind.
Barbara goes on to explain that there are three main questions to consider. First, what is the probability that the tortoise would remain in that location for 30 years without intervention?
For this one, she points out that with the slow travel speeds of a tortoise, they generally prefer to stick to one area. Calling this place home permanently is therefore only logical.
Second, what is the probability that the tortoise would have been moved or taken in and cared for as Spencer did by someone during those 30 years?
Here, Barbara points out that this species is actually known for burrowing, so it's highly likely that he may have dug a hole under a house or somewhere similar and carried out most of his life there, safely undetected by most people. As well, this specific variety lies dormant during colder months, giving him even less time to cross someone's path. Even so, there's really no evidence nobody else saw him, merely that nobody else had the knowledge or drive to take him in the way Spencer did.
Finally, what is the probability that the tortoise would still be alive after 30 years?
The lifespan of the tortoise notably raises the odds of the last point, as they're known to be similar to that of humans in length. Assuming he was lost as an adult, the tortoise also has very few predators due to its virtually impenetrable shell and the lack of predators who've adapted to this fact. With little more to contend with than coyotes, owls, and stray dogs, the tortoise likely had only to feed itself, and its survival was virtually assured.
Barbara goes on to say,
when we consider all of the factors, the one which brings the probability of this incident down the most is the temporal factor, the order and proximity of the events in time. It is certainly considerably lower than the average participant's chances of winning a football pool at their office. Still, it is much greater than that of my next-door neighbor winning the California lottery, yet that jackpot is won by someone's next-door neighbor dozens of times each year.
So by Barbara's standards, hardly a common event, but not necessarily earth-shattering, at least on a grand scale. But for Spencer and his friend, it was exceptionally startling. Speedy the Tortoise, however, could not respond to requests for comment in a timely manner.
For this and other stories, please be sure to visit theoddsmustbecrazy.com and add your vital opinion to the comment threads. If you're lucky, someone might be wrong on the internet.
Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, circle us on Google+, and validate us in life. Hit the Submit a Story link on our site to share your own crazy stories, or tweet the short ones with the hashtag TOMBC.
The Odds Must Be Crazy is a project in collaboration with the Independent Investigations Group in Los Angeles, California. Visit them at iigwest.org. Barbara Drescher is a contributing editor to our blog and can also be found at icbseverywhere.com.
And until next time, don't forget to critically analyze every single crazy story you hear and tell your friends tiptoe away whenever they see you. Or just send them to us and we'll take the hit.
Again to Wendy, Jarrett, and the gang at IIG West for taking the time to put together another informative and interesting segment for our show. Next up is an interview I recorded with my friend and contributor to this show, Bob Carroll. This interview was done a little while back, before he had Bob start to submit his segments. In fact, it was this discussion I had with Bob which gave Swoopy the idea to get Bob to start his regular contributions. I had realized that this interview became something like a lost interview. Since me and Bob talk a bit about his new book and his expanded work with the Skeptic Dictionary, I couldn't just let it go to waste. So, Bob, we haven't had you on for a while.
It's been a while, yeah.
Oh, gosh.
I miss you guys.
It's been, oh wow, almost 7 years?
Well, that was the first time, yeah, right.
It'd be 2005.
Yeah.
Wow. It's
been a while.
I'm getting old.
Don't tell me about getting old, please. Please.
So
you're still a baby compared to me. You're a pup.
Well, my brain doesn't think I am.
Oh, okay.
Last time we had you on, we talked about your Skeptics in Dictionary, and you had the website for that, and you've kind of expanded that, and you have a couple more new ventures as well. The first thing we can talk about a little bit is you expanded the Skeptics Dictionary to actually have a kid's version.
I do. I have a kid's version. I was pushed into it by my grandkids and my wife, more or less. That was not something that I can claim credit for having an original idea, but I'm glad I did it. My grandkids are now 13 and 11, and they were probably 8 and 11 when they started pushing me to do some writing for, you know, for their age group. So I've picked nine years and up, you know, so you and I count as up, right?
Yes.
We're in the up part of the kids. And, the fun part was, and the hard part was picking topics that would be of interest, of course, to kids. There's no point in picking topics that I'm interested in, but no kid would care about. So things like monsters were a natural. You know, there were just some topics that kids are going to like. They like the aliens and the flying saucers and things about animals. So I could throw in psychic animals. Have a whole instead of having separate ones and all these different cats and the horse and what else, the psychic parrot and the psychic dog. I could put them all into one entry on psychic animals. And but it was rewarding to do a different kind of writing. I don't consider myself a children's author, and it's really a special kind of writing. I had to do research on how those people who are successful, like Diane Swanson, for example, who's probably one of the most successful writers for children. I studied a couple of her books just to get an idea. And then there's some other writers who have been generous, like so many people on the internet, and have shared some of their tips for children's writing. And the main thing I can pass on is don't insult the kids by trying to talk down to them. But you do have to be careful with your vocabulary. There's certain kinds of words that a nine-year-old just not going to relate to. But you don't have to talk down to them. You can find words that they can understand. But the hardest part and the most interesting part is finding illustrations. Now, how do you describe, you know, 13 billion years so that a child can understand what that means? Even adults have trouble, you know, understanding a deep space and deep time. Anyway, that was a venture that I guess last year I posted about 40 entries, and I've added a couple since then. The last one was on the Big Bang.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So where can you, is that just part of the Skeptic website, or does that have its own website?
No, well, it's on my website. It's just SD for 4 with the number 4, sdforkids.skeptic.
What has been the reaction to that? Has it been pretty popular? Or?
Well, I got some very nice feedback when I first put it up there. Got a great shout-out from Kylie Sturgis in Australia. And her, she did an interview with me right after it was posted. And then Phil Plait, you know Phil, he's been on your show many times. He gave a great shout out for the Dictionary for Kids, and I've got a couple of other shout outs here and there. But a lot of people, when I tried to find out who knew about it, many of the websites on mentioned Phil, and they just took what he wrote and put it on their website. So it was great. You know, it's great to have that kind of snowball effect. But the only complaint that I've gotten so far has been from adults. Who would ask me, I've had several, ask me, what? Nothing about gods? Or, excuse me, they usually say God. And immediately, you know, something's fishy here, because we don't necessarily just use the word God like it's Derek, you know, like it's somebody's name, right?
Yeah.
We can talk about gods, but, boy, you talk about... A topic that is something that you could do a lifetime of work on. But anyway, no, I don't have any entries on gods or leprechauns or Easter Bunny or Santa Claus. I do have the Cottingley Fairies, because that's kind of an interesting... the ones that I chose, the topics that I chose, were specifically not only that I thought I could interest children in, but I could also show and tell some critical thinking skills. Like the Cottingley Fairies, there were a few people who weren't thinking very critically. You know the story, so I'm not going to go into it.
Oh, yeah.
They weren't thinking very critically. Including some pretty smart people like Arthur Conan Doyle, and yeah. gave me an opportunity to write about the kinds of tricks that the brain can play on us, and how we can deceive ourselves into believing what we want to believe, and not being critical when we should be critical. So I do have the one on the fairies, but nothing on... Thor or any of the other hundreds or thousands of gods that have been, you know, in mythology. I do have a list of, on either side of the main list of topics, I have a list of what I call sciencey websites and sciencey books. And the top book that I have recommended for kids is Dawkins' The Magic of Reality. I don't know if you've hasn't had a great book, and for those who want their kids to learn about mythology and its relation to science, that's the book I would get them.
Yeah, and even has a great story about from the beginning all the way through. It's really nice.
It's a wonderful book. Yeah,
and the illustrations in that are perfect. Geez.
Yeah, they are beautiful.
So. Basically, you just stick to the Scooby-Doo topics.
I suppose Bigfoot, you know, that's always popular.
Yeah.
Crop circles. But I liked, like I said, to pick things where I could teach some critical thinking techniques without being didactic, without being too preachy. So I did try to pick a few topics that would be humorous, like urine therapy and that kind of thing. But and then I purposely chose the Mayan Prophecy 2012 because of, I guess it was a year ago, I was at Skeptical. I did a, it wasn't a presentation. I just kind of conducted a discussion at this Skeptical conference we have in Northern California. I think this is the third or fourth year. It's in Berkeley. And the Sacramento Skeptics group and the Bay Area, that, for those who don't live out here in Northern California, that's the San Francisco Bay Area Skeptics, they jointly put on this conference. And I had a teacher come up to me after my session, and she was telling me about she teaches in a Montessori school, and she was telling me how a child was just in hysterics and had gone to a secretary. And the child was in hysterics because she had heard about the Mayan prophecy and the world was going to end. And she thought the secretary might comfort her. Well, the secretary told the kid, no, the Mayans are wrong. The world is going to end, but it's this other guy, this Christian engineer who predicted the end of the world. You know, he's the one who's right. So I'm thinking, oh boy. But it turns out there really are a lot of people who are scared by these fearmongers who put books out like Mayan predicted the end of the world. So I put that one in there and a couple of others just aimed at trying to soothe some of these ridiculous rumors that and hoaxes that people play, not realizing how much harm they can do by scaring young kids and adults into believing stuff that doesn't have a chance to be true.
All you had to do is like just put up the list of all the past predictions that the world was going to end.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been like about a few thousand.
There is somebody who did that, by the way. It's on the internet. I found it. It goes back a long, long way.
Yeah, it goes all the way back to like, you know, the 1000s. It's
even
crazy.
Before that, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Was it Jesus himself said the world was going to end within his lifetime?
His first group thought, you know, that was it. They were the last generation.
And you also branched out to having Skeptic on the as an app for the Android and iPhone.
Well,
right?
It's the fellow who did that for me did it for the iPhone, and his app works for the iPhone and the iPad.
So you have the app, you have Skeptic's Dictionary for kids, and then recently you just put out a book.
I did. Yeah, I called the book Unnatural Acts. And the thing that I really liked about it was that as I was getting ready to look for a publisher, I was talking with DJ Grothy, the president of the James Randi Educational Foundation, and he said, "Look, we're trying to start a program where we will publish, the JREF will publish electronic books. And, you know, you can get your share of the profit, and then we get a share, and then whoever, Amazon or whoever else gets their share. And it's a way to make a contribution to the JREF, as well as to get to use all their resources to publicize your work." And so I immediately agreed, well, that's wonderful. So they read it and looked at it and agreed to publish it. So the James Randi Educational Foundation is the publisher. And I think so far the only other books they've published are a few of Randi's classics and a book on homeopathy by Oliver Wendell Holmes, an old book, which, by the way, if you get that book, it has an introduction by the Skeptoc, Harriet Hall, Dr. Hall.
Yeah.
And it's really worth buying it just to read her introduction. Very very good introduction to the book.
I read that. It was really good, especially for that topic.
It's excellent. So, yeah, that's out. The subtitle is Critical Thinking, Skepticism, and Science Exposed, with an exclamation mark. And the main reason for calling it Unnatural Acts is that I've been using this kind of hook for quite a while in talking about critical thinking, that it really isn't, it's not instinctive. It's not something that we do naturally. We have to be taught to go against our natural instincts and natural way of making quick judgments and using all these heuristics that people like Tversky and Daniel Kahneman talk about in thinking. In fact, I was just finishing up my book when Kahneman's book, Thinking Slow and Fast, came out. I don't know if you've read that, but it's a great book. And I was able, before the book mine was actually published, was able to read some of the reviews. I wasn't able to get the book. It wasn't quite out yet when mine came out. But I knew this was exactly the kind of book that would be a follow-up to my book, because throughout it's mainly about critical thinking and the difficulties that anybody who sets out to become a critical thinker is going to face if you're really serious about it. It really does not come naturally. It's something that goes against our grain. And so I ended up in the last chapter with a list of 59 plus ways to improve your critical thinking, and a lot of them are discussed in Kahneman's book, and they've become. I decided, in fact, bring in Harriet again. Harriet Hall was reviewed the book for me, and she, in fact, she's got a review she's going to publish, I think, in Skeptical Inquirer. But she was one of the readers, and she said, "Oh, I was disappointed when I got to the last chapter that all you did was list these 59 fallacies and biases and illusions, and only it gave a short description. You didn't go any further." So I was able to bulk that up a little bit, but then I decided, well, why not just continue this with a blog, and I'll just do lengthy posts on things like, well, the last one was on the straw man fallacy. And since the politicians have been supplying us with great examples recently, that was very topical, it turned out. So I've started that blog with just each entry. I've been doing it about weekly now. Each entry is on one of the illusions, cognitive illusions or cognitive biases or fallacies of reasoning that hinder people from thinking critically, but which we tend to naturally move towards, and we need to develop some tactics for avoiding these biases that can mislead us.
Yeah, you have to be taught to be a critical thinker, yeah. And that's something that a lot of people don't realize.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it's critical thinking is, of course, part of what any scientist has to do. And you're just not born as a scientist. You're not born skeptical. You're not born asking yourself, oh, wait a minute now, am I jumping to a conclusion here? No, our natural instinct is to jump to conclusions and think now incorrectly and think correctly later. It's like Kahneman describes it as almost if we have two brains, you know, one that works on very little stimulus. It just is natural, and he calls it system one thinking. Basically, what he calls system one thinking is what I call natural thinking. It's our instinctive way of looking at things. And then system two is more reflective and more critical. That's what we strive for, I think, in the skeptical movement, is to get to a more reflective, fairer, more comprehensive view of things than what our perception or immediate perception tells us is true.
If we did all that naturally, there'd be less arguments.
We probably wouldn't be having this conversation. You know, if we did it naturally, the world would be much different place. You know.
So you have the blog, you have your new book, you have skeptic stuff for kids. What else?
I'll tell you what, the blog, the new blog is keeping me busy because I actually decided once I got started with it that if I do this, if I keep it up with the 59 plus things that I've listed there, I'll have another book at the end of the year with 59 plus chapters in it. So I'm trying to write these pieces pretty carefully and with an eye to maybe publishing them as a unit when I get a whole collection of them. But it's the kind of writing where you'll go back to it, you let it sit for a while and then go back to it. And I don't know, if you follow some of the bloggers, you can tell that they sit down at the computer, write whatever comes into their head, and that's what they post that day. And sometimes they go on forever and sometimes they don't. But a lot of times there's it could be improved if it were rewritten and so on. But, you know, who's got the time for that? When you're a daily blogger, it's pretty difficult to do a lot of rewriting. So I've decided to go slower, post maybe once a week instead of every day. And then during the week, after I've written something, I can go back to it 3 or 4 or 5 times and rewrite it, put stuff out. Maybe some new politician will come up with a new fallacy or be exposed for something that I can write about. That, by the way, that's one of the pleasures, I think, of doing this kind of writing instead of the Skeptic's Dictionary, is that the Skeptic's Dictionary and that whole way of presenting material kind of limited me to not certain topics were kind of off base, like politics. Whereas with a book on critical thinking and a blog on critical thinking, there's no area that is off limits. Politics is open a topic as the paranormal or the supernatural. So I've been able to expand. In fact, the book on Natural Acts, since it does deal with critical thinking and skepticism and science, isn't limited to topics of the paranormal. There's a lot of examples that come from the social and political and moral or ethical world. I don't know where else you'll find a book that compares Newt Gingrich with Idi Amin, but you'll find it in that book.
Great. So where can people find all of your stuff or find out more about where you might be?
Well, all the stuff, of course, is at skeptic.com. That's the main site. You can get to there's links to the Unnatural Acts blog, to the book, to the Skeptic's Dictionary for Kids. So it's just S-K-E-P, D as in dictionary, IC.com. All right. Great. Good talking to you, Derek. Thanks.
Great,
thanks
very much. Good talking to you.
This is Bob Carroll, creator of the Skeptic's Dictionary and the blog Unnatural Acts. Welcome to another episode of Unnatural Virtue. Today's topic is the availability bias. Most human judgments are made under conditions of uncertainty, and rather than investigate and reflect before judging, we use heuristics, or simplifying shortcuts of intuitive thinking, as Daniel Kahneman describes them. These shortcuts bias our judgment, and if we are not careful, can lead us into error or regrettable actions. The availability bias is the tendency to make judgments based on the speed with which memories are aroused and become available to the conscious mind. If the content of these memories is based on solid knowledge, the availability bias may lead to quick, reasonable judgments. In such cases, our judgment is made under conditions of minimum uncertainty. But we often make judgments under conditions of high uncertainty, and what first comes to mind is influenced not by knowledge, but by what we've recently experienced or been exposed to by the mass media. After 9/11, for example, many people canceled their airplane reservations because they believed it had become less safe to travel by air. Though the chances of harm coming to airline passengers didn't increase by the acts of terrorism on that day, in fact, shortly after 9/11, it was probably safer to fly because of the increased diligence aroused. Another example of the availability bias leading to an error in judgment is demonstrated by opinion polls regarding the prevalence of crime in the United States. The crime rate decreased all through the 1990s, and for the last decade, crime rates have remained steady. Yet between 52 and 89% of Americans every year since 1990 have thought that crime is on the rise. During a five-year period in the 1990s, the homicide rate nationwide dropped by 20%, but the majority of Americans believed the homicide rate was increasing. Coverage of murders on national evening news programs during that period went up by 721%. But it's not just the excessive coverage of crime by the news media that influences our judgments about crime. The abundance of television shows and movies that feature crimes also plays a part. My last example of the availability bias leading to an error in judgment comes from personal experience. A couple of years ago, a person close to me was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and dementia. I began paying more attention to media items dealing with topics of the elderly losing cognitive abilities. I subscribed to Skeptic magazine, and a copy arrived during the period I was preoccupied with these issues. I was taken aback while reading James Randi's column. A goodly portion of it was identical to something I had posted on my blog, Mass Media Funk, 8 years earlier. What first came to my mind was that Randi was suffering some sort of dementia. I knew he had been having health problems and that he was nearly 80. I've known Randi since the first amazing meeting in 2003, and it never occurred to me that he would intentionally use my material. I don't believe Randi has a dishonest bone in his body. I contacted a few people close to Randi with my concern about his cognitive decline and was relieved to find that his mind was as sharp as ever. He had been undergoing chemotherapy, and an assistant had prepared the column in question from notes Randi kept on his computer for a book he was writing. The assistant mistook Randi's notes from my blog for his original writing. One famous study on the availability heuristic was done by Norbert Schwartz and a group of German psychologists in the 1990s. They tested people to see what effect requiring them to list a specific number of instances of an event would have on their impression of the frequency of that event. You might think that the greater the number of instances you could list, the higher you'd estimate the frequency. But the results didn't work out that way. Why? Because it's easier to come up with a few instances of something than it is to come up with a larger number of instances. And the harder it is to complete a task, the less frequent we think the instances are. This finding opens the door to manipulators. If you want to have a group of people, say, rate your podcast favorably, then give them an evaluation form with a request that they list 10 ways the podcast could be improved. The difficulty of the task might lead them to think that your podcast couldn't be improved very much, and they might evaluate you more favorably than if you just asked them to rank your podcast on a scale of 1 to 5. The first narrative that comes to mind when making a judgment might seem intuitively correct and highly plausible. To avoid making faulty judgments because of the availability bias, it might help to stop and reflect. Ask yourself if you are being unduly influenced by the media, personal experience, or some strongly held belief. Consider alternative narratives and, if possible, get more information. For more on the availability bias and how it can be used to manipulate people, see my entries on the topic in the Skeptic's Dictionary and in my blog, Unnatural Acts. For more on this and other cognitive biases and logical fallacies, check out my ebook, Unnatural Acts, Critical Thinking, Skepticism, and Science Exposed. In the meantime, please commit some unnatural acts in public. And don't forget, skepticism, though unnatural, is a virtue.
A couple weeks back, I had somebody send me a YouTube link about a rational skeptical comedy tour which is about to kick off in the upcoming weeks. Since many skeptics seem to enjoy a good laugh, and comedy has always been a great way to convey some of the toughest issues, I figured this comedy tour might be something that lots more skeptical folks might be interested in. So I called up Ian Harris, one of the funny minds behind the Evolution of Comedy Tour.
Three of America's top rationalist comedians on tour together in select cities. Ian Harris.
I was at the bookstore the other day, and they have a book in there called Christianity for Dummies. And I was like, oh, the irony.
Jason Ressler.
I was born in 1972. Abortion was legalized in 1973. Yeah, my mom didn't have a choice.
And Maurice Northup.
Finally found my girlfriend's mysterious G-spot. It's in Wyoming with my best friend.
Have some intelligently designed material that'll turn your beliefs upside down.
You and I will not get along. Because cancer is the most emotional of all the signs.
The Evolution of Comedy Tour. If you like smart, edgy comedy, it's the natural selection.
And I'm a Virgo. And Virgos are very rational and very logical. Like, yeah, apparently not, because you believe in astrology.
For tour dates and other information, go to theevolutionofcomedy.com.
So, Ian, I have you on. You know, I think you might be the first person on our show who's actually only came claim to fame is being a comedian.
Oh, really?
We've had funny people on the show, but nice. Who actually don't do it for a living.
Really? Have you guys ever had a comedian on?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, wow.
We've had,
I feel honored.
We've had musicians on, we've had scientists on, skeptics, authors, people from TV, writers, but nobody's just a comedian.
It's funny because we were talking earlier, there's a high number of comedians who are, who I would say like atheists and skeptics, but they talk about it, but they don't really talk about it. But when you talk to them one-on-one, you go, wow, this is a really high percentage of people that are, you know, of a similar mindset, yet you don't hear much of it, you know?
Well, yeah, and it's funny because there's a few comedians we've tried to get on, but, you know, timing doesn't work or, you know, they're busy or whatever. So, hey, you get to be the first one.
Nice. Well, I'm honored.
So, why don't you tell everybody who you are? Because, okay, you're a comedian. They know that. They know your first name is Ian.
Yeah, there you go. Well, it's Ian Harris. I'm a comedian. I've been doing comedy for going on 20 years now. And, I've started a comedy tour, which is designed for, we're targeting the skeptic community, the atheist community, the non-believing free thought community. And our tour is called the Evolution of Comedy Tour. And it's myself and a good friend of mine, Jason Ressler, and another comedian named Maurice Northup. And we've just started out. Our first official date is actually in April. And we're just, our goal is to provide entertainment for, you know, like I said, non-believers, free thinkers. I mean, there's a ton of comics out there that I said, like, believe the way I believe, but they don't do an act that is, you know, targeted for this demographic. And I think we're a demographic that's ignored by the media. I mean, you see, you know, all types of religious programming and you know, themed programming for women, programming for men, you know, programming for this group or that group. And there isn't a whole lot of entertainment that's programmed for free thinkers and non-believers. And I'm not sure exactly why, because we're a pretty significant portion of the country and of the world, and we're growing. So my thought was, hey, let's provide some entertainment for them and let's start, you know, really making some awareness, and hopefully through comedy, people who are on the fence might see the logic through comedy by laughing at it, which I think a lot of people tend to start thinking about stuff when they're laughing and when they're having a good time with it, and they see the absurdity of things, it makes people think.
Yeah, I noticed that this has started to become more of a trend in the past couple of years with people like, Tim Minchin and Steve Martin, even.
Yeah.
So I think there's more comedians coming out of that closet, so to say.
Yeah, exactly. I think, I mean, the funny thing is Tim Minchin's even said, he goes, I don't want to be just called the atheist comedian. It's, which is cool with him. I mean, it's cool for me. he just does what he does and what he thinks is funny. And he's a great musician and he's a great comedian. And but people have latched onto him because they're starved for intelligent entertainment that you know, that is geared toward them. And the person that's really championed it a lot, I think, too, is Ricky Gervais.
Yeah.
Who is not even a stand-up comedian, or didn't get his start as a stand-up comedian, and has, you know, in the last few years, found it as a medium, and he's been, I mean, his first two stand-up specials were phenomenal, and you know, his Twitter, everything he ever says on Twitter is about, you know, is somehow related to atheism and his, you know, his film the Invention of Lying. And I mean, he's really championing it. God, I can't even talk. Anyway, he's taking it on. But you know, so that was my thought, was that, you know, aside from Ricky, who's way, you know, way up on the evolutionary entertainment chain, you know, that I figured, well, he's not playing the comedy clubs in Tucson and San Francisco and so that's where I needed to. That's where I'm in, and I'm on my way. I'm, you know, on my way building up from there. So I thought, well, let's do something that's geared toward the everyday people, and you know, see what we can do with it, and see if we can create a little movement. And yeah, it's. I think there's a lot more people starting to come out, but still, no one's really claiming that as their thing. You know what I mean?
Especially in that touring comedians at the local level.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, say on the larger scale, aside from Ricky Gervais, you know, even like, say, even Tim Minchin, he's definitely, that's where he is. But when you ask him, his, you know, well, I do music and I do comedy and I do, you know, he has a bunch of different things. He's not just, hey, I'm the skeptic comic. That's not what he does. I mean, there's a few of them, but there's not enough, in my opinion. I mean, there's no reason that we can have, you know, a million Christian comedians and four atheist comedians. Just, you know what I mean? I mean, there's plenty of room.
So you said this is like a tour. So where is your first, like, how big is the tour? Is it just North America? Is it just the West Coast? Where are you guys going?
Our plan is, we're just getting started. All right. We're doing the West half of the U.S. right now. That's our first few dates. And our goal is to go, you know, as big as we can go with it. We're going to start smaller. We're doing the comedy clubs, and Bill do smaller theaters. And then from there, hopefully branch out. We've already talked. We've set some, we've talked to a few people in the UK, Ireland, and England, and working on setting something up there. We've got dates in Tucson, San Francisco, San Jose area, Sacramento. We're working on Portland, Denver, Austin, and doing comedy clubs. And then eventually, like I said, we're hopefully build into the small, like the 400 to 800 seat theaters, and just kind of build a name and let the show speak for itself, you know. And instead of trying to, you know, we toyed with, oh, can we get a celebrity to, you know, celebrity comedian to come on? And we thought, you know what, the theme itself is going to be what draws people, and then once they come, they're going to love the show, and that's what's going to keep people coming. That's the goal, anyway.
Create the buzz that way.
Exactly. So,
because I've seen, you have some YouTube clips about with you and some of the people that are on the tour.
Well, yeah, we have our website. It's theevolutionofcomedy.com, and yeah, we have a YouTube channel. You can search for us, Ian Harris, Jason Wrestler, Yeah, I mean, I also have a YouTube channel for my first hour special that I'm doing at the end of the year. That's I'm going to be doing on the day of the Mayan apocalypse.
You'll be done by that, won't you?
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I keep telling the distributors and the cable company. It's like, hey, HBO, just take a chance, because you know, we're probably not going to be here anyway. So you won't have to worry about it. And if it happens, then great. If it doesn't happen, then we'll all be dead, and you don't have to pay me anything. But yeah, so I have YouTube, and it's called youtube.com/apocalypsecomedyshow. And yeah, and you know, hopefully that's going to go. We're working on a deal that'll be able to air it live, and we can talk about that in the future when it's all signed. But yeah, that one is, my goal on that one is to do I always thought somebody should have done a comedy show on Y2K at midnight and just said, hey, look, we're still here again. When are we finally going to realize that these are BS, that there's no apocalypse coming? So when I, when I was working on this hour special and we were talking about dates, and I said, well, let's put it down the road. Who knows? Let's wait till the world ends. And the guy I was talking with, another famous skeptic who I won't call out, but he said, hey, that's when you should do it. That's a great time. I said, hey, that is a good time. And we're going midnight. We're actually going Eastern time. So 9 o'clock on the West. And basically it'll be December 22nd, but we're doing it December 21st at midnight and going live. And it'll be interesting just to be able to, hey, look, the world still has not ended.
So, I always tell people, like, you know, if you think this is true, pull out your wallet. Take any random credit card that you have. Look at the expiration date.
Right.
If it's after, you know, 2012, it's 2013, do you think that people who have all that money are, like, all planning not to be here?
Right. I always go, hey, if, you know, yeah, the Mayan calendar ends on December 21st, 2012. You know, my calendar ends every year.
Yes.
And I just go and buy a new one. It's really not that deal.
And then the problem is Mayans still are around, and they all think it's crazy.
Exactly. And why do we have this worship of people? It's the same thing with, like, you know, when people go, and I'm not trying to bag on our founding fathers or anything, okay? I'm sure the founding fathers were fantastic. I'm a big Thomas Jefferson fan. But people who lived 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, 2,000 years ago, why do we act like they have some sort of special knowledge that we didn't have? Why, you know, when people go, well, when we just get into the argument about, oh, it's a Christian nation. Well, first off, we can argue about that. But second of all, even if people 200, 300 years ago decided that they were going to found a country on Christianity, guess what? We have new information now. We don't burn witches anymore. There's a lot of things. We don't have slaves anymore. There's a lot of things that those people back then were wrong about. So why do we have to worship them just because they were around when the country was founded? Or why do we have to worship the Mayans because they might have been more advanced than other people of their time? Like, who cares?
Well, like I said, the funny part is the Mayans still exist, and they all think it's kind of funny. In fact, they are making money from it. So there's groups of the Mayans that are actually doing tours of all that stuff because of the monetary gain, because of people.
And then the other thing is helping. If you want us out there, let us know, and then let your, you know, local, if you have a comedy club, you know, if you're in Denver and you want us to come out, contact the local comedy, the Comedy Works or whatever, and say, hey, we want to see this tour here. And that's how, you know, like anything, that's how you're going to get out. It's like with the advertisement, you know, if people know that the city wants them to have the show, they're going to have it. And if there's an audience for it, they're going to welcome us. And so far we haven't had a ton of resistance, but, you know, there's thousands of comics who are trying to get into clubs every day. And, you know, I think we're unique, but we definitely need help showing every city that there's an audience out there. And, if you live in a city and you want us to come out there, let us know. Hit us up on the website and send an email or give us a call and let us know where you're at, and we will contact your local club and we'll try to set up a date.
Well, then you heard them. If you live in, like, Barrow, Alaska, where it's, like, you know, average temperature of 21, then call your local comedy club, the Ice Cube or whatever they call it.
Yeah, the Ice House. That's in Pasadena. Yeah. No. If you live up there, then you'll go to Juneau.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for jumping on the show. And when you get more information, send it to me. Maybe we'll have you on for an update.
Yeah, thank you very much. This is great. I really appreciate it. And keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
to find out more about the evolution of a comedy tour and the comedians who are involved and how you can get your local comedy club to host the tour, please head over to our show notes. Maybe you can have a fun and funny night in your neck of the woods. I hope you're enjoying our attempt to add more content to the show and give you more and somewhat longer episodes. Make sure you take the time to go to our website where you can find all the show notes and links to the stuff you heard here and how to submit your own science shout-out for next episode. As always, at skepticality.com.
WHFR, Dearborn.
Hammond Planetarium will be hosting a spring star talk titled Nothing Gold Can Stay from Tuesday, March 20th through Saturday, May 29th, 2012. It's taking place in the Science Building, Room S-126. HFCC instructors Dale Van Dorp, the voice of Dearborn, and Susan McGraw will be the event's narrators. This event is free and open to the public. No reservations are necessary, and seating is available on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information, please contact Steve Murrell at 313-317-1536. And for show dates and times, check out hfcc.edu under the events page.
Taylor, WHFR, Dearborn.
Is this on? Thank you. All right. Good morning, students. This is your principal speaking. First period will be replaced by sleeping in. Second period will be replaced by batting lead.